opening is Lang versus Evans, superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. The light is indicated in the podium. I'll just mention what I failed to mention in our last argument, which is that there are you'll see three microphones in front of you, and you are free to use the microphone that's closest to you out of any concerns you might have about COVID or other viruses or diseases. Counsel, please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the recording only in an audio format, and this helps us to attach you to your arguments when we post the argument to the public. Counsel for appellant, with that, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will elect the middle podium once again. When Your Honors are ready, may I proceed?
You certainly may.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. My name is Mitch Zillman. I'm a certified student attorney, and I'm here today with my supervising attorney, Bradford Colbert, and I'll be presenting on behalf of the appellant, Martin Lang. And for today's argument, I'd like to specifically focus on two of the issues Mr. Lang raised in his briefs that I think most highlight the fundamental unfairness that's present in this case. The first issue I'd like to focus on is the state's broken promise that Mr. Lang would not have to register as a predatory offender. And the second issue I'd like to discuss is the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's 17-year delay in forcing Mr. Lang to register. And there are three critical facts in this case that decide this case in Mr. Lang's favor. The first is that the state induced Mr. Lang into pleading guilty to a non-predatory offense by promising him that he would not need to register if he so pled. The second critical fact is that to ensure Mr. Lang would not have to register, the state dismissed an entirely separate criminal complaint that contained a predatory charge against Mr. Lang. And the third critical fact is that the BCA, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, forced Mr. Lang to register anyways 17 years later. Under those facts, the state, through the BCA, violated the predatory registration statute, equitable principles, Mr. Lang's due process rights, as well as fundamental fairness as a whole. Mr. Lang asks this court to rectify this miscarriage of justice and to protect.
Is there a difference between due process rights and fundamental fairness as a whole?
Thank you, Your Honor, for that question. I don't think in certain cases, under certain circumstances, the due process inquiry might focus on more specific questions, such as when it comes to the inducement of a guilty plea, the question is whether the state induced that promise or whether the state induced
that
guilty plea.
I'm trying to get a sense of your argument, though. Is there a distinction you're making between your due process claim, your procedural due process claim, and this fundamental unfairness that you say is pervasive?
No, Your Honor. The ultimate question for Mr. Lang's, with respect to the state's promise, is whether fundamental fairness requires that that promise be enforced. And that is where the unfairness in this case began, was with the state's promise. In this due process context, that promise needs to be enforced to uphold fundamental fairness against the entire state of Minnesota.
Mr. Zillman, you've argued various legal theories to get at the facts that you've described. Which of your theories do you think is the most promising given the existing case law?
It's hard for me to answer that question, Your Honor, as we feel that all of our claims are meritorious. But I think the most obvious injustice in this case is from the state's broken promise. It's a matter of intuitive common sense for most citizens that they need to be able to trust in the promises that their government makes them, or else if citizens don't trust in those promises, our legal institutions could break down.
And you've tried to address that factual issue in various ways with various issues, with various theories and arguments, and it seems like each of them has some well-established case law, often that creates obstacles for you. And I'm wondering, for example, on your statutory argument, about whether the fourth degree and fifth degree offenses arise from the same set of factual circumstances. That seems fairly clear. But, for example, why would we not apply the Thibodeau case instead of the Hawkos case?
Thanks for that question, Your Honor. And I think the most important point is that we are not challenging whether the conviction and the separate complaint pertained to the same set of circumstances. We agree that the alleged offense and the eventual conviction arose out of the same set of circumstances. The question is whether Mr. Lang was charged with a predatory offense within the meaning of the predatory registration statute. And he was not, because as our Supreme Court discussed in the Lopez case, there must exist probable cause to stand trial on the predatory charge to require registration. And
Mr. Zillman, maybe I've finished Judge Johnson answering his question, but on that point about probable cause, I wanted to see if you can clarify for me the record. As I understand it, probable cause was not raised in the criminal proceeding, so it wasn't ruled upon by the court. Is that correct? But your client's not here raising a probable cause, and the district court only addressed it indirectly by referencing the face of the complaint, which I assume per the Hawkos case is not sufficient. What is the status of the probable cause for that fourth degree offense from your client's perspective as it relates to the requirement to register?
Thank you, Your Honor. And the status of that probable cause finding is that it's null and void because the complaint that gave rise to that probable cause was dismissed. And just to illustrate that point, I would posit a slight hypothetical, changing the facts slightly. Let's say Mr. Lang had been convicted of that fourth degree charge. And let's say that later on it was found that that conviction was wrongful and the conviction was vacated and dismissed. I don't think anybody would dispute that that just because Mr. Lang had at one point been convicted, that he would still be required to register. And the legislature couldn't have intended a different result with respect to probable cause.
The fourth degree charge was dismissed not because of a lack of probable cause, but because of pursuant to a plea agreement, right?
Correct.
And on the day before trial, before the trial was scheduled, he was set to go to trial on the fourth degree charge, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Isn't this case a lot like Thibodeau?
The facts do appear to be similar, Your Honors, but this court didn't address the issue of whether probable cause can exist in a dismissed complaint in Thibodeau. That point was never raised. And as we discussed at length in the briefs, the ultimate source of probable cause to stand trial is the criminal complaint, and there can be no probable cause without that criminal complaint. So Mr. Lang isn't required to register as a predatory offender, Your Honors. And even if he were, again, the state fundamental justice requires that he not be required to register due to the state's broken promise. And in this, because Mr. Lang's due process rights are at issue, the BCA must be held to the state's promise as well. But even if we weren't in the context of due process, I would just note that there's no issue with holding the BCA to the Scott County Attorney's promises because, as contractual doctrines often put it, the BCA and every county attorney of the state of Minnesota are in privity. They are executive criminal law enforcement agencies that represent the state of Minnesota that are created by state statute. So they are closely related agencies. And indeed, they often collaborate in the investigation and prosecution of criminal cases. So they're essentially, they're closely related. And in the context of registration specifically, The BCA doesn't have any power or interest or authority whatsoever to force somebody to register unless and until a prosecutor has used his or her own discretion to obtain a conviction that would trigger registration. So there's especially little separation of powers concern here with holding the BCA to the state's promise, and Mr. Lang is entitled to enforce that promise.
Well, so you've cited the Santabello case as a case law for your right to enforce a promise that led to a plea agreement. I mean, Minnesota case law allows, vindicates Santabello with a post-conviction petition, right? Motion to withdraw a guilty plea. I don't think your client has done that. Isn't that available to your client now to go do that, to petition the district court for some remedy based on that alleged promise?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Lang is not required, nor can he successfully bring a post-conviction claim to withdraw his plea. And there are three basic reasons for that. Number one, as we discussed in our briefs, the statute of limitations for Mr. Lang to raise such a claim expired well over a decade before he had a chance to contest his predatory registration.
But there are exceptions to the two-year statute of limitation. Has that argument been exhausted?
There are exceptions, Your Honor, but that actually goes to the second reason why Mr. Lang actually can't withdraw his plea, and that's because the claims that Mr. Lang is making in this case don't go to any of the statutory criteria for post-conviction relief that are in the post-conviction statute. I think it's useful to look at the Puckett case that we cited in our principal brief. In that case, the Supreme Court of the United States said that a promise by the government that is later broken doesn't retroactively render the guilty plea invalid. In fact, the court said that it's precisely because the plea was both voluntary and intelligent that the plea is valid, and hence the state is required to fulfill its promise. So once again, Mr. Lang is entitled to enforce the state's promise, and he can't do that in a post-conviction proceeding. But at the end of the day, that's all beside the point, because the real question is, what is the remedy that fundamental justice requires? And requiring Mr. Lang to attempt to withdraw his plea would not comport with fundamental justice. Mr. Lang pled guilty in reliance on the state's promise. He served his entire sentence in reliance on that promise and then lived an additional 14 years in reliance on it.
Regarding the promise that you're saying the state should be bound to, can you discuss the effect of Limmer, State v. Limmer, on the idea that there was an enforceable promise?
Thank you, Your Honor. We don't think State v. Limmer, if it has any bearing in this case, that bearing is very little. That case was about collateral estoppel, which is a procedural doctrine as opposed to a constitutional doctrine of due process. It's more...
I'm not talking about your constitutional argument for due process. I'm talking about your promissory estoppel argument.
Thank you. Well, as I mentioned already, the BCA and the Scott County Attorney are closely related. They are in privity, as the contractual doctrines often put it. But it's also our position that's not required necessarily in this case. With respect to Lemmer, I would just note that the agencies here are far more closely related. They're not trying to, they don't have independent authority in independent legal proceedings. They essentially have the same job, which is fighting crime. So to the extent you don't decide this case on due process grounds,
Explain then how you distinguish that from the circumstances in Lemmer.
Well, in Lemmer, the question was whether the Department of Public Safety was bound to an acquittal, whether the Department of Public Safety, in bringing an implied consent proceeding, was bound to an acquittal that occurred in a completely separate criminal case that just happened to involve the same set of factual circumstances. That's not the case here, Your Honor, that we're dealing with two matters that flow from one another. There has to be a conviction of a predatory offense, or the statutory criteria must otherwise be satisfied, and that interplay was not present in Lemmer.
Mr. Zellman, just on the, since we're talking promissory estoppel, I don't think the judge relied on this because the focus was privity, but is it an undisputed fact that a promise was made that your client would not have to register as part of that agreement?
We believe it is an undisputed fact. There's no genuine dispute that the state indeed promised Mr. Lang that he wouldn't have to register if he pled guilty. He alleged in the complaint that the state made this promise, and he's provided substantial evidence to support that claim. And in return, the state has provided nothing. So there's no genuine dispute of material fact. There's at most a metaphysical doubt about whether the promise occurred, and Mr. Lang is entitled to enforce it. And that leads me to...
Am I correct? I mean, the district court considered it to be an alleged promise, right? I mean, I don't think that the district court did not accept your view, did it?
I don't think the record is entirely clear on that. The district court simply stated that the BCA didn't make any promises on the notion that it matters whether the BCA specifically or the county attorney made the promise. The district court does not appear to have explicitly said whether there was a promise or not.
Well, looking at page 7 of the district court's order, it said, here the promise at issue, ... is alleged to have been made by the prosecutor, not the BCA. It seems like the district court was treating it as an allegation, not a established fact.
Thank you. I'll answer that question, but I see my time is up. To the extent the district court didn't find that a promise existed, we think that this court can still rule on this issue, and if need be, the case can be remanded for further fact-finding. But we think there's no genuine dispute of fact about whether there was a promise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
I'll go over here. Hopefully I can still keep track of the yellow dot. May it please the court.
We'll let you know if you're getting too close to the
end. Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case. With respect to the first issue on the statutory claim and the applicability of it to Mr. Lang, the case law is clear in Thibodeau, in Lopez, and Lopez specifically talks about a dismissal of the original charge does not change the registration requirement. Thibodeau specifically addresses the fact of two different charging documents. The Gunderson case also addresses the fact of two different charging documents. It's just very clear from the case law that he's required to register under these statutes, and I don't think that Hakos is inconsistent with that. I don't think you have to say, we're going to rely on Thibodeau, we're going to rely on Hakos. I think Hakos is consistent. Hakos was only looking at one complaint because there was only one complaint in that case. It wasn't a case where the dismissal, was dealt with in a different complaint. But in Hakos, he didn't challenge probable cause until after sentencing, and ultimately the Hakos court, at least from my understanding of that, ultimately they said there was probable cause on the basis of the complaint at the time of the charging. So,
Ms. Kiza, on that point, though, isn't it clear from the case law that's not sufficient for registration purposes? It must be a Florence probable cause analysis to determine whether one, even under the same circumstances, must register.
No, I don't agree with that. There has to be probable cause and then a conviction out of the same set of circumstances. But, I mean,
ask it another way. Wouldn't you agree that the probable cause analysis of a judge signing a complaint is much different than a Florence standard? And it seems like the case law in our own cases, through this civil process, there has been an analysis typically at the district court and perhaps a de novo one here, looking at police reports that may be in the record to determine under Florence whether there's probable cause.
I think where it's still been challenged, I mean, there are maybe too many cases now on these registration issues, but a lot of the cases, they're just based on a conviction out of the same set of circumstances, whether or not probable cause was challenged. I think when it's specifically come up that it's been challenged, then that's been taken into account as part of the record. But I think that under Hakos, I think that BCA can certainly rely on a, you know, probable cause in the initial complaint that was uncontested.
Well, my question, though, is in this posture, though, once, and I understand that point because if it's not raised in any formal way, but once it's raised in this way, in a formal way, through its Mr. Lang's complaint against the BCA, does not the, at least at summary judgment stage, the BCA have to establish via Florence that there's probable cause for the dismissed offense? Because in our case law, that's the only basis, at least as I understand it, for which a dismissed, same circumstances, registerable offense requires an individual to register.
And I certainly think the court in this case did say there was probable cause, even just based on the face of the complaint. And if you look at the face of the complaint, as we argued in our brief, it is clear there was probable cause for attempted fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct. He was assaulting her, trying to have sex with her. But he had a dildo in his pocket.
That's why I'm talking about the distinction of signing a complaint and what's on a complaint. That we know, for instance, a factual basis cannot rely on a complaint in order to support a charge. And so the complaint can say all kinds of things, but when we're talking about now the requirement to register for a dismissed offense in a dismissed complaint, is not there an obligation of the state to establish probable cause via Florence to withstand summary judgment?
I guess I don't know if I agree with you that there would be, but if there is, it is certainly present in this case. I mean, we argued that below. We argued the probable cause below, and she found that there was probable cause based on the record. There was no challenge. In fact, he specifically acknowledged.
But just to clarify, the record is the complaint. So the only basis, it was not a Florence probable cause. It was a complaint probable cause only.
Well, right, because he waived any chance to supplement the record for a complaint. Or for a probable cause challenge when he didn't challenge.
Well, let me oppose it a different way, hypothetically. Let's assume all the facts are the same, a waiver of a Florence issue, instead it was a suppression. Later, a defendant, it could be in a post-conviction petition, it could be in this matter, raises objection to being required to register because there's a lack of probable cause via Florence for that dismissed offense. Is that not an appropriate issue that the BCA would have to, in that case, prove that there's probable cause for that dismissed offense?
I'm not quite sure if I follow, but if the BCA had information, let's say they get the court records, and they have a finding by the court that there was not probable cause and then there was a conviction, they wouldn't require registration because they don't meet the case law under registration.
So the flip side is a waiver doesn't mean that's foreclosed when it comes to registration. It's a waiver for the criminal case, but that's the reason we're here today is we're not talking criminal now, we're talking the registration. And so it sounds like you're agreeing that the probable cause is an element of the BCA requiring someone to register for a dismissed offense. And that probable cause needs to be more than simply the face of the complaint.
Well, I don't agree that the probable cause needs to be more than the face of the complaint. I think when the BCA is applying the registration statute, they can look at the record, and in a case like this, the statute provides that the court's supposed to provide these records at the time of the plea, which obviously didn't happen in this case. But the court's supposed to provide is the complaint and the sentencing documents. And I believe that the BCA, where there was no challenge of probable cause, of the initial complaint, there's a conviction on the same set of circumstances, they can rely on the face of the complaint.
Do you agree that if probable cause were successfully challenged in the district court in this proceeding, that would remove the basis for the registration requirement?
I think that could, yeah. I mean, I think it should have been challenged. They had the chance to challenge it in the criminal case. Obviously, it should have been.
Then we would review de novo the district court's determination as to probable cause.
I certainly think you could do that.
I mean, if it had been challenged and preserved for appeal, the issue of probable cause.
Yes. Yeah, I think that you could do that. I mean, that's happened. I mean, that's kind of what happened in Lopez, I believe. I think Lopez looked at the record and found probable cause. So I think you would have that ability to do that.
Ms. Keyser, the district court's memorandum on page 1 of the memo says that in February of 2001, at the contested omnibus hearing, plaintiff did not challenge probable cause, which was found. What's that statement based on? I don't see a document in our record that supports that statement.
And I don't know. I just know there was a contested probable cause hearing, but I don't believe it had to. I mean, I'm sorry, there was a contested omnibus hearing, but it didn't have probable cause rates as the issue.
How do you know that? How do you know that? I mean, what's your source?
That was in the record below and the exhibits below. There was information on all of the proceedings, including that record. So that should be, I don't know.
Documents, you mean? I mean, not transcripts.
Yeah, the exhibits that were attached to our motion for summary judgment below would have had those documents, but they're not part of the appendix here, but they were exhibits that the court considered below. And we had all of the everything basically from the court documents attached to that. So that's what she would have relied on in saying that. But I can't point you to specifically which one it is at this point. And with respect to the promissory estoppel claim, I do think that Lemmer does govern that, and I think that's very close factually as far as whether promissory estoppel should apply to prohibit the BCA. I mean, this is a case where...
Just to be clear, if we disagreed with you on the legal premise of Lemmer and the distinction between, you know, the parties and privity and who has the authority to make the promise, would you agree that we would then need to at least remand to the district court to determine the nature of any promise?
If you said they were in privity?
Right.
Probably, yeah, because then you would be holding them to the alleged promise, which, you know, even in his affidavit, he says it was his understanding. That's what he says. It was my understanding. He doesn't say the prosecutor said this. This is my attorney says this. So it's my understanding he wouldn't have to register. If you look at the plea petition, it doesn't say anything about him not having to register. And the plea petition actually specifically talked about that he had the chance to challenge probable cause, too.
Is it correct that the state didn't introduce evidence, though, in the district court, or attempt to introduce evidence to challenge that understanding?
What do you mean?
Evidence as to what, if any, promises were made, testimony, affidavits about any conversations that went on the record or off the record in order to draw his plea?
No, what we presented was what we had in the records from the court and from the BCA. So, I mean, that's part of the issue with this whole, with our whole argument on the plea withdrawal being the remedy in this case, or it's an attempted plea withdrawal, and he hasn't even attempted. The prosecutor is going to have, you know, they're going to be the ones that are going to have the information and knowledge on what happened, you know, with this case. So it's not something that the BCA, again, the BCA in administering the statute shouldn't, and, you know, there are something like 18,000 registered offenders, right? I mean, they shouldn't be in a position to have to defend probable cause on every case where somebody doesn't challenge it below. It's just, their role is to administer the statute when somebody fits the statute. And in this case, as far as the delay is concerned, I mean, it is unfortunate. The delay is unfortunate. But in this case, it doesn't prejudice him. I mean, he would have had to register for 10 years from the time of 2000, but then it would have been restarted in 2004 when he went on a probation violation. It would have been restarted in 2013. It would have been restarted in 2016. It would have been restarted in 2019. So he would still be registering. I mean, he, in effect, didn't have to register for 14 years that he should have registered, or 16 years that he should have registered. But it doesn't prejudice him in that regard. He was going to have to still be registering for this offense. But, I mean, the language originally said in the statute was 10 years from the time the person's initially required to register. The language initially said 10 years from conviction or the termination of supervision, whichever was later. The legislature changed that language so that now it says 10 years from the time they're initially registered. And the Vaughn case is persuasive authority, but it does talk about how the kind of theory is, you know, 10 years offense-free in the community, you know, monitoring someone for that time.
Why shouldn't we be concerned about state mischief? You know, individual is charged with a significant offense that require registration as a predatory offender. The state then changes the charge, leaves the facts in place, but changes the charge entirely, as it happened in this case, so that there's no longer a need to register, dismisses the, gets a plea of guilty, dismisses the earlier complaint, and then waits over a decade to tag the defendant with the obligation to register. You're not concerned, or you don't think we should be concerned with just principles of fairness?
Well, I think that principles of ethics should govern attorneys, prosecutors. You know, in this case, if this was done to avoid registration, that it shouldn't have been. But the fact that the BCA didn't get the information, you know, once they did, they followed their statutory responsibility to get him registered or attempted to. It took him 2 years because he was out on a warrant status when they first attempted it. But
I'm not talking about those 2 years. I'm talking about the years before.
Right. But, I mean, no, I don't think, you know, and maybe I'm looking through rose-colored glasses, but I don't think, I mean, I think prosecutors have ethical responsibilities and
so you're saying it wouldn't happen intentionally, but why would that bear upon the fairness from the perspective of individuals in Mr. Lang's shoes?
Well, I think in Mr. Lang's case in particular, for the reasons I said, you know, it's not prejudicial to him. You know,
Ms. Keyser, can I ratchet down Judge Ross's question in a little bit more detail? And I apologize, Judge Ross, this may run over.
No, go ahead.
I'm troubled with your comment with regard to probable cause. And here we've got a case where the BCA simply looks at documents of a dismissed, not only charge, but complaint, but dismissed offense. And I'm looking at the Haukos decision, and your point being is they can rely simply on the probable cause statement in a complaint to determine he must register, therefore. And when I look at Haukos, the quote from the decision is, that is, it's the judiciary's determination of probable cause, not the prosecutor's bringing of the charge, that triggers the statutory basis for sex offense registration. Our court then goes on to say, we also note that one of the purposes served by a probable cause determination is to relieve the defendant from the expense of an ignominy, pronounced correctly, ignominy, of a prosecution, citing to Florence. So my question is, what basis does your client have, and I understand your position here, it wasn't raised, but just as a general matter, and this maybe goes to the potential mischief of simply relying then on a probable cause statement of a dismissed offense to require someone 10 to 14 years later to register without looking at police reports to determine whether there indeed was sufficient Florence standard of probable cause at a minimum.
Well, I mean, they sometimes look at that if the probable cause in the face of the complaint, if it's same set of circumstances. If you look further at Haukos, I feel like at the end of that opinion, they talk about the face of the complaint was sufficient. And the judge signs off on complaints. They're as a matter of course, under the rules, they find probable cause at the initial hearings in the criminal case. So whether, just because it's not a contested probable cause finding, the court is signing off on that probable cause on the complaint. And if it's not contested, you know, the court is finding that, at least initially in those proceedings. So and you know, again, it gets to the administration of 18,000 cases. They have to be able to rely on the record, and the statute provides for the court to provide those records, which implies that they should be able to rely on them.
Ms. Keyser, I have a few more questions, if Judge Ross will allow. Please. It has to do with, you would like to, I mean, your position is that his remedy, if any, is found in the post-conviction statute. What about the long delay? I mean, would you concede that a petition would be timely now?
Again, I'm not the prosecutor, and I can't say for the Scott County attorney, I can't waive that. I'm not, you know. So there are exceptions to that 2-year rule.
Would you concede that any exceptions apply?
they could apply if he meets that. I'm not conceding they apply, but even if they don't, that's not, I mean, that's what his remedy is. It's between him and the prosecutor. If they made a promise that, you know, he relied on. If you look at the Zinsky case, that was like 20, maybe it wasn't 20 some years later, but the Zinsky case was way delayed. And they did say that it wasn't barred by the 2 years. So, I mean, there's certainly some persuasive authority in that regard.
And you speak about the post-conviction remedy as being plea withdrawal, but isn't it true that he also could, with a post-conviction petition, get specific performance under Supreme Court case law?
I think he could ask for it, sure. Specific performance or withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean he wouldn't have to register, so either one would be kind of the same.
Well, withdrawal would mean he would have to go to trial, I suppose.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Yeah, I think he could ask for either.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, one moment. Thank you.
I would just like to raise a few points in rebuttal.
A reminder, state your name with your beginning.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mitch Zillman, presenting on behalf of the appellant, Martin Lang.
Thank you.
The first point that I wanted to raise, just to clear up some confusion about the whether the district court in the criminal case found probable cause. With respect to Mr. Lang's statutory claim, that whether that finding occurred does not matter, because there can't be probable cause if the complaint was dismissed, and thus vacating and nullifying any probable cause finding that might have existed. And
you don't dispute, do you, that your client could have challenged probable cause in this case and then appealed if the district court decided against? In fact, your client did challenge probable cause in this case, and your client chose not to appeal it. Would you agree that if you did raise it, lost it, and appealed it, you would get de novo review in this court as to whether there was probable cause for the dismissed complaint?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
in this case, wouldn't that resolve any due process issues?
Can you rephrase?
Wouldn't that eliminate any concerns about due process as to whether your client had the opportunity to challenge probable cause as a predicate for the registration?
No, Your Honor, and that's for two reasons. Number one is that the Minnesota Supreme Court didn't clarify that probable cause was necessary to require registration until the Lopez case later in 2010. So there was no clear, it wasn't clear what the result of any of challenging and appealing any probable cause finding would be. But more importantly, Your Honor, is that the state induced Mr. Lang into pleading guilty by its promise. So that really changes the calculus.
I'm focusing on the due process issue. You're challenging registration now going forward. So if we were to review probable cause, if it had been raised to us, and we held that there was no probable cause, it's game, set, and match, right, for your client?
Are you referring to in the prior criminal case, if that had happened then?
Now.
Correct, yes. That would clear up any due process issues because Mr. Lang wouldn't be required to register, and that would fulfill the state's now broken promise. And I think that's why it's so, that's why Mr. Lang didn't have a fair chance to challenge probable cause in the criminal case. And to go to your inquiry, Judge Slider, about, whether it's sufficient to find probable cause in the face of the complaint, it is not. And that goes to Mr. Lang's procedural due process claim because he's established a liberty interest under the stigma plus test, and he is entitled to a meaningful opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful way. And with the state's promise, Mr. Lang didn't have that opportunity in the district court. The state has also mentioned that there was nothing in the plea petition about the promise, but as, for example, in the Cosby case, the promise doesn't need to be in writing. As long as Santabello says, as long as the defendant relied on that promise in entering a guilty plea, that is sufficient to trigger due process. And then I just want to address the plea withdrawal as a remedy. First of all, as we've mentioned, Mr. Lang is not able to bring that claim at this point due to the statute of limitations and due to the nature of the claims that he's bringing.
How do you know until you try?
And well, that's the point, Your Honor, is that he can't be required to merely attempt to do so. At best, it's a murky question for Mr. Lang if he could withdraw his plea. And there's a statute of limitations on these claims
here. But you're asking us to speculate that he would fail if he brought it, if he brought such a challenge.
Well, the court doesn't need to speculate. While this isn't a post-conviction proceeding, this court is in a good position to evaluate the facts and the law and determine whether Mr. Lang has a post-conviction claim. None of those facts are law.
If he asserted a post-conviction claim and succeeded, wouldn't that also resolve his challenge to the registration requirement?
No, it wouldn't. It would not, Your Honor, because that would. First of all, there can't be declaratory or injunctive relief in a post-conviction proceeding. And second, even if they're
raised in a post-conviction, if you challenged the basis for the plea, if you're saying, "Look, I was promised something I didn't receive. I have a constitutional right to withdraw my guilty plea." Why wouldn't that resolve the issue of probable cause?
Thank you, Your Honor. I see I have a few seconds, so I will answer that question and then conclude. That wouldn't resolve any due process issues because it ignores the fact that Mr. Lang, upon plea withdrawal, would have to face these criminal charges all over again after he had reasonably believed for many years and the case that he wouldn't have to register. And this criminal case faded into obscurity. So there's a high likelihood of spoliation of evidence, that memories have faded, that certain witnesses might even be unavailable. And that's assuming it would even be fair to force Mr. Lang to litigate this case all over again and possibly face the risk of even harsher punishment. So for that reason, Your Honors, we would ask for relief.
If I may tweak Judge Ross's question, if your client filed a post-conviction petition and asked for a specific performance and the district judge granted that relief, then that would make this case moot, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zillman. Thank you, Ms. Kiesa. The matter is well briefed and well argued.